Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Are scientists free to think and free to follow the evidence wherever it leads? I'm Casey Luskin with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, broadcasting with the ID the Future podcast in Seattle, Washington. We have on the show with us again today, Dr. Carolyn Crocker, president of the American Institute for Technology and Science Education and author of the recent book, Free to Think, Why Scientific Integrity Matters, where Dr. Crocker tells her story of being expelled from George Mason University due to the fact that she taught students about both evolution and intelligent design. Dr. Crocker formerly taught at both George Mason University and Northern Virginia Community College, and she got her PhD in immunopharmacology at Southampton University in the United Kingdom. Dr. Crocker now lives in Southern California, and as I noted, she's the author of this new book, Free to Think, Why Scientific Integrity Matters. So Dr. Crocker, thanks for coming back on ID the Future.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, in the last podcast, we just talked about some of your own background, how you got interested in the debate over intelligent design, and just some aspects of being in the documentary Expelled, and how you interacted with Ben Stein, and your story was told in that documentary. And obviously, as you mentioned, only a few aspects of your story were told in that documentary because they only had a few minutes to devote to your story. And your new book, Free to Think, covers the story of what happened to you at George Mason in much, much more detail. So I want to reiterate to listeners what I said in the previous podcast, and that's that if you want to know the full story of what happened to Carolyn Crocker, check out her new book, Free to Think. And I don't want to give away your whole story here on the podcast, but I also feel that it needs to be told. So I'll say from the outset again that there's a lot more detail and fascinating anecdotes in your book that we won't even have time to cover here in the podcast. But let's start by talking about your experience teaching biology at Northern Virginia Community College. Was that a good experience?
Well, I have to say I love teaching, wherever it is. But Northern Virginia Community College was especially enjoyable because it is so multicultural. I don't think there was a majority culture there, and I must admit that the majority of students on the roll call, I couldn't pronounce their names. But that was great because there was very little opportunity for prejudice to arise, and I saw the cultures interacting and just learning from each other and having fun together. It was also great because so many of my students were incredibly highly motivated. I have to say that I started college in 1975, and you can figure out how old I am, but things were different then. I'm the daughter of immigrants, and we didn't have a lot of money, but I was able to live at home, and my father paid the tuition for my bachelor's degree. Now, as the eldest of five kids, I did have to work in the home, you know, taking care of my younger siblings and, you know, doing housework. And also, I worked about 10 hours a week as a waitress. But I have to say, in comparison to the students at Northern Virginia Community College, my life was easy as an undergraduate. Many of my students lived on their own. Many were single parents. They had to balance a full-time job and school, and they were also dealing with heartache from their past, a lot of them with family circumstances that were very painful. And what impressed me so much was that many of them did it very successfully. For example, there was a night watchman who always used to walk around the back of my biology class instead of sitting on a chair, and that was so he could stay awake because he worked at night and went to school in the day. Now, he didn't get the grades he was capable of, but he passed, and I was so proud of him. Or there was a former foster child who I talk about more in my book who took buses at night to get to the study groups and ended up with an A in the class. Or there was a single mother of three who I also talk about in the book who wanted to go to medical school, and so she would faithfully come to the classes. When her child care didn't arrive, she would actually bring all three kids with her to the lecture. And to my amazement, she actually made them behave. She came top of the class. These kids are not survivors. They're overcomers. And I think they'd inspire anybody, which is one reason why I included a lot of their stories in my book.
Well, Dr. Crocker, what you just talked about actually corresponds very nicely with the next question I want to ask you, and that is that your book contains a number of heartwarming stories of your own interaction with students at Northern Virginia Community College, or NVCC, and it actually made your book a very enjoyable and amusing read when you tell these stories. In fact, what really struck me was the lengths to which you would go to help your students and at times even care for some of their life needs. And to be honest, this makes me all the more disappointed, although not at all surprised, by many of the really quite despicable attacks on your character out there from evolutionists who have tried to paint you as just a terrible person when they have no idea who you are and what kind of a person you are, and just the lengths of which you opened up your own heart and your own life to help out many of these students who were facing some pretty big obstacles just to get their most basic educational needs met. And so I want our listeners to hear it directly from you. And, you know, you don't need to praise yourself. I can praise you. But, I mean, do you feel that it's the instructor's job to just present the material and leave everything else up to the students? Or does a professor have some responsibility to also learn about a student's personal needs and, when given opportunities, find ways to help them to, I don't know, to do life better, for lack of a better term? How do you feel about the role of a professor?
Honestly, I don't think that's the role of a professor. I believe it's a professor's job to present the information in their course as clearly as possible, to package it so that students can understand it enough to evaluate and apply it. I think professors need to do more than just regurgitate what's in the book. They need to make it palatable to the students so they understand it. I think that's very important. That's more than memorizing, but it's actually helping the students to be free to think, which is what I'm keen on, obviously. But I'm also aware that the students I had at NVCC did much better in my class than those at George Mason. The difference being, at NVCC, I had 25 in a class. At George Mason, there were 150. And so at the community college, I was able to make individual relationships with students, and that made them in the class, I believe. There was no other difference. I don't know what else it could have been. So I do think that the professor having a relationship with students does help the students to learn. On the other hand, I don't think this is the professor's responsibility, but it might be their privilege, like it was mine. But I'm also very aware that in our current academic environment of large class sizes, this simply isn't possible. And so I would not want to say that that's a professor's responsibility. But again, I would say sometimes it's their privilege.
Well, that's great. Now, I want to give our readers a little hint here. Your book, Free to Think, is not just an enjoyable read, but it also does a great job explaining some scientific concepts, such as basic cellular processes like transcription or translation or intracellular transport. So I'd just like to ask you a scientific question here, Dr. Crocker. Why, in your opinion, do these sorts of processes show evidence for intelligent design?
Well, I'm aware that some of your listeners will know what transcription, translation, and intracellular transport are, and others will not. But what I will say is that all these processes require information. That information is contained in DNA, and it looks like in other places in the cell as well. And there is also information contained in the exquisite nanotechnology of the machines found in the cell. Based on my understanding of cell biology, I don't think that these exquisitely functioning controlled machines could have resulted from random mutation and natural selection. But we do have past experience to know where information does originate. That is, in our experience of the world, information originates with intelligent beings. Basically, if we see evidence of engineering, we assume there was an engineer. If we see a painting, we assume there is a painter. To me, this is simple logic. So when you see exquisite nanotechnology in the cell that rivals and, frankly, beats out anything we can do, I would say that that is evidence of intelligent design.
Well, let's return back to your story of what happened to you at George Mason. After you started teaching at Northern Virginia Community College, you then also started teaching at George Mason. When did you start at GMU, and what are some of the differences between Northern Virginia Community College and GMU?
I started at George Mason University about 2 years after I had started at Northern Virginia Community College, and I started first doing some adjunct work, and then I went into full-time cell biology teaching. The differences, well, there were several. They are in the same area of town, and so the multicultural student body was very similar. More of the students at George Mason were having help from their parents, so the students weren't quite as independent, perhaps, as those at the community college, where most of them were, you know, working for their own education. And you could see a difference in the attitude. Class size was a big difference between the community college and George Mason, in that the community college class size was 25 to 50, depending on the class. And at George Mason, it was 150 plus. And so the students could easily get lost. Another thing that I think made education at George Mason more difficult for the students was that George Mason had rules about attendance. That is, teachers were not allowed to require attendance. Now, I understand that when students go to university that it is time for them to do, make their own decisions about such things, but I think giving that amount of freedom in the first year, frankly, they failed. And so we had a huge failure rate at George Mason, and I think a large part of it was simply because the students were told, you don't have to go to class, and that is a disaster. Also, George Mason had rules about cheating. Their rules were, if you are going to discipline a student for cheating, you must actually report that to the officials at the university instead of just dealing with it on a one-to-one basis. To me, that really blew it out of proportion. And the result was that a lot of the professors at George Mason, in fact, the dean of students told me, no professor in the biology department had reported cheating for many, many years before I started there. And I don't think that does the students any favors, because let's face it, if you cheat to get through school, eventually you will fail. And that's very sad. The lecture halls were very different in that, you know, at George Mason, they were huge. They had every mod con you could expect. When I was at the community college, the ceilings were dripping. And quite often we were sloshing through water on the floor. It was very different. And finally, another big difference was my supervisor at the community college was a wonderful, ethical, caring lady who just really loved her students. She was such an inspiration to me. Whereas at George Mason, well, you can read about my supervisor there.
I definitely recommend people read your book for the details here. So let's get into what happened to you at George Mason. Some have suggested that the reason you were let go from George Mason was simply because your contract was over. And in fact, the NCSE's attack on Expelled tries to really muddy the waters. And this is quite amusing because on the one hand, they suggest that you were let go, quote, simply for staffing reasons, unquote. And they go on to say that, quote, we do not know for certain why Crocker was not rehired for her non-tenure-track job, unquote. On the other hand, they try to impugn you by claiming that you received student complaints and were, quote, unwilling or unable to teach accurate science, unquote. So which version of the NCSE's story is true? Were you let go for innocuous reasons that had nothing to do with your teaching performance, or were you ousted because you were a bad teacher? I mean, obviously, their contradictory theories can't both be true. And I would say that the truth is that neither of their stories is correct, although maybe perhaps some there thought that you were teaching bad science, even though they really just weren't willing to give you academic freedom to question Darwinism, which the NCSE would equate with teaching bad science. So let's hear it directly from you. What really happened, and why were you let go from George Mason University?
Well, I would say that the NCSE appears to be just as confused as my supervisor was, because he also gave a lot of different conflicting reasons in his correspondence with the grievance committee. And so I would encourage people to read that, because it does make for an amusing read as they twist themselves in knots trying to say lots of different stories. What I will say is that my supervisor at George Mason University, another faculty member at George Mason University, and the departmental administrator all said that the only issue that my supervisor had with me, the reason he removed me from lecturing, was because I was teaching on evolution. All of them said it. The story then changed, however, I believe when the legal people at George Mason got involved, I noticed that the story began to change and they began to say other things like, oh, her contract was over, or she was just a bad teacher, ignoring the many commendations I'd had and the grants, etc., and also the student letters. You can see the mix-up in their stories in the correspondence between me, my supervisor, and the College of Arts and Sciences Grievance Committee. All of that, all those documents are actually in my book in the appendices, so people can see for themselves what happened. Also, I would say that the NCSE is right and that my contract was over. But what I have not said publicly before, and what I do reveal in the book, and I guess I'm revealing it now, is that I had a 3-year contract. That was switched with a 1-year contract, and yeah, my 1-year contract was over. But as you can see, the story is a lot more complicated than what was revealed and Expelled or what the NCSE knows.
And what you allude to in your book, and this is a very fascinating story that readers should get your book to get the whole story, is that, as you just said, Dr. Crocker, originally they gave you a 3-year contract, and then when they decided that they wanted to get rid of you, the evidence sort of suggests, and some of this is inference based upon what happened, that they switched your contract behind your back and claimed that it was only a 1-year contract. And you know for a fact that originally you signed a 3-year contract, and then they came out with a different document and claimed it was a one-year contract, and it sure seems like something shady was going on there, and they were trying to get rid of you more quickly than they otherwise would have been able to. And, you know, I want to also just say something here. The pattern that you experienced where basically at first they claim and they sort of openly admit that this was about television design and evolution and challenging evolution, but then when legal action sort of starts to loom on the horizon, they immediately change their story and they come up with what we call in the law a pretext, basically a given reason for why somebody did something that is not the actual reason. And we see this over and over again in these persecution stories where initially the administration acknowledges, yes, this is about intelligent design. And then as soon as it becomes public that someone is basically acting in a discriminatory fashion and not granting academic freedom for intelligent design, then they start to change their story and they come up with all these bogus pretextual explanations. And we saw this in Robert Mark's case. We've seen this with the California Science Center. And we also saw this in Guillermo Gonzalez's case. And another thing that's very similar, in Guillermo Gonzalez's case, the Iowa State University faculty handbook gave high praise to academic freedom, calling it the foundation of the university, but yet his colleagues refused to extend him the courtesy of academic freedom to hold pro-ID viewpoints. And I see a very parallel problem with your situation at GMU, where, as you write in your book, that the GMU faculty handbook provides that faculty should be allowed, quote, unrestricted expositions on subjects within one's field without fear of censorship or penalty, unquote. And that sure sounds to me like it should grant a biologist that is supposed to be teaching a course that covers evolution some academic freedom within your field, of course, to talk about your views on Darwinian evolution. And do you feel that they practice what they preach when it comes to academic freedom and evolution at George Mason University?
Well, no, I don't think so. In fact, unrestricted exposition on subjects within one's field, well, certainly evolution was part of the cell biology course, and that the course was supposed to be on the structure, function, and evolution of cells. I also was very careful to cover it in a balanced way where my students did not even know what I thought. But obviously I was censored in that I was immediately removed from teaching, and I was, or rather from lecturing, and I was penalized in that I found my job was over. So obviously, they don't keep to what the faculty handbook says. But on the other hand, what I will say is that I don't think they actually understand what intelligent design was or is, and they also didn't actually look to see what I taught, in that they obviously thought intelligent design was religion, at least that's what it looks like from what was said in the Nature article, and they weren't about to assess it for themselves. Also, the fact is I really didn't teach much ID. There was one lecture out of 25 where I talked about evolution, and only two or three of the slides were on intelligent design. It's not like I did a whole course on ID. I just mentioned it as a theory that some scientists were considering. I didn't even say that I believed this. I just said it was some scientists are considering it. And I also have many student letters saying that they didn't know what I believed. Those letters were sent to the grievance committee, and they are in the book, but obviously they were not addressed by the administration at George Mason.
You know, I think that the student response to you, Dr. Crocker, is actually very revealing in terms of what actually happened here. So can you tell us very briefly about some of the teaching awards and grants and praise that you received from George Mason by those who weren't really privy to your quote-unquote science sins, as you put it in Expelled, but who were just looking at your teaching evaluations and your performance as a teacher? What were they saying about you?
The semester before my discipline, I had a letter from the provost congratulating me for high student ratings. And then actually it was kind of funny because when I went to my office after the discipline, the first thing I found in my mailbox was another letter from the provost, again congratulating me for high student ratings. I had a nomination for a teaching award from one of my students. Obviously, a grant from the Center for Teaching Excellence, where I and one of my students worked together to try and improve student grades in large class settings and did succeed, and he did present a poster on that. I had two grants from Technology Across the Curriculum. Details about all of those are in my book.
Yeah, and I think this is really important because a lot of folks, especially the NCSE's really misguided attacks on Expelled. Their website is full of misinformation when you read it. I mean, they were trying to paint you as a bad teacher, and yet some of your administrators who were not upset about, or maybe they didn't even know yet about the fact that you had committed the grave crime of mentioning ID, but they were just looking at your student ratings and said that your teaching was outstanding as, quote, evidenced by unusually high student rankings, unquote. And I think your provost said, this kind of teaching quality is essential for this vital educational program, and we're very grateful for your successful efforts. So this hardly sounds like they're describing a teacher who would soon be expected to lose her job for supposedly poor teaching abilities. And it's very clear that when you did lose your job, it was for something that was contrived. And I would encourage our listeners, if you want to see some direct rebuttals to a lot of the misinformation that the NCSE has put out about Expelled, Discovery Institute, we've actually got a website called ncseexposed.org. That's ncseexposed.org that responds to a lot of the false claims. I think that we already know the answer to this, but didn't your students stand up for you when they found out that you were no longer going to be lecturing and when words started to get out as to why you were not going to be lecturing?
Yes, well, the students wanted to stand up for me, and actually I was contacted by many students who said they wanted to form a group to go and protest in front of the university officials, which I found very heartwarming. But I actually told them not to, because my academic future, well, I don't have that many years left, but they do. They have their entire lives in front of them, and I didn't want to see them penalized for standing up for me. So I told them not to, but what I did do was I asked them to write letters in my support, because those could be made anonymous. And many of them did that. Those are in the book. I'm still in contact with several of the students, and in fact, one of them I had asked to appear with me in Washington, D.C. at the press conference about my book.
Well, that's excellent, Dr. Crocker. And I don't want to get into this part in very much detail. I think it's a really fascinating story that's told in your book, but you were actually not the only person expelled from this incident. And in fact, the preface of your book is written by Mr. Ed Sisson, an attorney who was very kindly willing to give you pro bono representation. And without giving away the whole story, can you briefly explain how Mr. Sisson started off as an advocate for you and ended up as a victim himself?
Mr. Sisson would say that he lost his job for unrelated reasons. But the fact is that when I was contacted to be told that I was going to be fired as a client from Arnold and Porter because George Mason had objected to their representing me, Mr. Sisson did lose his job, or he was notified of his job loss the same week. And again, those details are in the book, exactly what happened. And also, obviously, he wrote the introduction for the book.
Well, there certainly are a lot of interesting tidbits in your book that are probably not told anywhere else. So I'd really encourage our listeners to check out Dr. Crocker's book, Free to Think, Why Scientific Integrity Matters. It's available on Amazon.com. And on July 24th, Dr. Crocker is going to be speaking in Washington, D.C. at a press conference about her book. So Dr. Crocker, thank you very much for telling us a little bit about your story, what happened to you at George Mason.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Stay tuned for more with Dr. Carolyn Crocker and her new book, Free to Think, Why Scientific Integrity Matters. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.